Okay, we're going to look through chapters 4, 5, and 6 here. This is dealing with giving, biblical giving. And as I talked to several of you in advance about, you know, what were you interested in, this is one chapter, I think, that will address something you are interested in. And because of that, I'm going to go through it in a little more detail. Biblical giving, in addressing that subject, we're going to look at some principles here. Principle number 4 comes out of Romans 6:14. The sin shall not be master over you, but you are not under law, but under grace. And then 2 Corinthians 3:5-8. Not that we are adequate in ourselves to consider anything as coming from ourselves, but our adequacy is from God, who also made us adequate as servants of the new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. And then moving down to verse 8, how will the ministry of the Spirit fail to be even more with glory? The principle is the law given to Israel through Moses, and the manner in which God has dealt with and will deal with Israel is not the same as his manner of dealing with believers of this age. An important distinction there. We're going to come back to this principle because there are a number of Christians who have been exposed to teachings that are really law-based. There's one fellow I talked to who said that he had gotten the counsel that, well, God wants you to give 10%, and if you haven't been giving some 10%, you need to give 10% plus catch up with what you didn't pay in the past. And until you do that, God won't bless you. Right? Well, that's based on what Lord gave to the Israelites. That's not based on what the New Testament teaches. We'll go in detail into what the New Testament teaches here. This Malachi 3:8-10 passage is one that's fairly commonly given. As a matter of fact, there's a church I remember up in Reno. They had giving slots, not just they didn't pass the plate, but they had this verse right underneath the slot. Okay, will a man rob God? Yet you are robbing me. But you say, how have we robbed you in tithes and offerings? And by the way, tithing is what's typically taught, and one of the points we'll get to here is a lot of churches will go and latch on to the tithe. When you add up all the things the Jews were supposed to give, the figure was about 30%. Okay? The tithe was just to take care of the Levites, but that didn't handle all the other giving that they were supposed to do. So if you want to grab hold of Old Testament law, don't grab for 10%. You better go for the 30, because that's the full 9 yards, right? That's the full banana. So we got some numbers that start here. Number 1, towards the bottom of page 16, the tithe, as all the law of Moses was given explicitly for Israel. See verse 9 above. As quoted above in Romans 6:14 and 2 Corinthians 3:5-8, church-age believers are not under the law of Moses. That's where one of the common and principal criticisms I would have of like Larry Burkett's approach and in our day, Dave Ramsey's approach. Both of those guys latch onto the tithe, and it's not biblical. If they're going to be thorough about that, then they better make sure they don't have their lobster and crab for lunch, and they better make sure they tell everybody 30%, not 10. Okay? All right. Secondly, the promise of blessing in Malachi 3:10 is not for the church of Christians, but for Israel, as the Lord told Israel he would bless them if they obeyed in Deuteronomy 28:1-14. Which starts, now it shall be, if you diligently obey the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments, which I command you today, all 613 of them, 365 don'ts, right? The Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth, that is, the Gentiles, right? All these blessings will come upon you and overtake you if you obey the Lord your God. The rest of the chapter, which is long, over 60 verses, okay? The rest of the chapter is all the curses if you don't obey. But it has to do with the land. And I promise if you obey, you will be free of diseases and all these things. Okay? Number three, the tithe was designed to provide for the Levites under the Jewish system of temple priests who had no land in their tribe. So what they did is all the tribes had land allocations except for the Levites, and they were to give 10% everyone to support the Levites and of that particular tribe. I'm a pastor, but not Levite, okay? I don't have any of the right ethnic background, and I'm not training. I have no idea how to slaughter a bull properly according to the Mosaic law. I've slaughtered animals, but not that. So, at any rate, they're supposed to give a tenth to provide for them. Then, we have no Levites, we don't have a temple, we don't have a service, and we don't have a storehouse for the food. Okay? We just don't have any of that. Okay? Four, those who try to make the tithe applicable to church-age believers conveniently neglect the requirements of the law that are in the immediate context of the tithe passages, like the list of animal meats that are not to be eaten, also in Deuteronomy 14, including pork, lobster, crab, and shellfish. How many forbid also eating these items, along with giving a tenth? Right?
How do they separate those two?
What do you mean?
Well, when they're saying that the they take the tithe passage for today, but they don't mention them.
It's a little bit like the Wizard of Oz, don't look at the man behind the curtain, because what they'll do is they'll look at the tenth, but they will not, look at the passage around it. So, again, it always comes to context, and plus they grab that one, but not the other things where money was supposed to be given, and, again, the number is more like 30%, not 10, when you add it all up.
So they just ignore it.
Yeah, they want you to as well. If you'd say, well, what about the food law right above that? Oh, that's not for us. Why? Well, they haven't got a good reason for that. So, no passage in the New Testament, this is number five, in the New Testament, epistles, reminds, encourages, or commands the giving of tithe, a tenth, to the church or to church workers. Notice the passage in Malachi speaks not only of tithes, but of offerings as well. Offerings is not just another word for money you give to the church. Offerings refers to the long list of Levitical offerings which Israel was to give. The total of the offerings and tithes and alms which Israel was to give was more than 2 to 3 times the tithe, so about 30% there. If Christians were to match that, they would have to give not 10%, but somewhere closer to 30% to fulfill the law of Moses. Here's an example, okay? Jesus is born. What do Mary and Joseph do? They go to the temple 40 days after, where that's where Simeon and Anna are found, right? Because they have to present Jesus at the temple, and they have to, because they're poor, they have to pay for a little turtle dove offering. Otherwise, you'd pay for a lamb or something larger. So you got that. You got a whole system of feasts and sacrifices. If this happens, you go to the temple and you pay for that sacrifice. It gets expensive with everything, and so it's about 30% of your income goes to all the stuff relating to supporting the temple and paying for the sacrifices and all that. So it's about 30%. Next one there. Number seven, the New Testament passage is given in the prior page to say that in contrast to the law, the manner in which the Lord deals with us in the church age involves grace and life and glory. Tithing as under the law does not bring grace and life and glory. All right, so if we're not required to give a tenth, what do the New Testament epistles say about giving to Christian ministers? Here's the fun part. Okay. The primary passages on giving in the New Testament epistles are 1 Corinthians 16, which we'll get to shortly in our main service, and 2 Corinthians 89, which we'll get to a number of months from now. In both passages, Paul the Apostle is addressing collection of gifts, giving and related issues with the church at Corinth. The passage is more than we can cover comprehensively in our allotted time, but it will be valuable for us to touch upon some key points that bring forth the biblical principles on giving to ministry. Okay, so we'll come up with some key principles right out of Scripture here. Here's Weiss' translation of 1 Corinthians 16, 1 through 4. Now concerning the collection of money which is for the saints, even as I gave orders to the local assemblies in Galatia, thus also for you, you do the same. On every first day of the week, let each one of you have the habit of putting aside at home whatever he may be prospered in, accumulating and keeping it in reserve, in order that when I come, then there may not be any collections. When I come, what? There may not be any collections. Oh, boy. How's that for a surprise? Okay. And whenever I come, whomever you will approve after having put him to the test, these I will send to carry your bounty to Jerusalem. And if it, the gift, be sufficiently large so as to warrant me also going, they shall go with me. So notice a few different things here. Notice that the collection is for the saints. It's for benefiting other believers. See that? It's not just to give up money because giving up money is good for you. Okay? It's for benefiting other believers, and it's not just to keep a program going. Okay? It's not just so that we've got stuff happening. It's not just to pay people and just to keep a program crank turning. The next one, Paul's directions were not just some private deal with the Corinthian church. Instructions were made objectively and openly. He made reference to this is what we do with the churches in Galatia. And that's five major cities for a start. So it's like, this is widely done. I'm not just telling you this. This is the way other churches are doing it too. So he's not just giving them a pattern that doesn't fit. There's an assurance here that, it does fit other Christians, right? Paul then asked them, set aside funds for the first day of each week. We would call that Sunday. That implies a regularity in accumulation for giving. So that's the other principle. Giving should be a regular thing. He has it here. Of course, they didn't have things like we have where you may get paid every other week or once a month or, you know, when the commission check comes in or whatever. But there is a principle of regularity, and he has it on a weekly basis. The next one. Next, Paul says, each one of you. This means the principle doesn't apply to some, but in fact all. Okay? So for all the Christians. He says that they are to put aside, so they are to take the initiative to see to it that they do it first. So it's initiative, it's not an accident. It's not, Paul said, what have I got? Scrambling for the wallet. Okay? Importantly, Paul's next phrase is, whatever he may be prospered in. This has a strong idea of accumulating for giving, not on presumption of some future income, okay, but in keeping with real actual income. There's also a sense of proportionality in giving, but no magical percentage. One of the things that churches will sometimes do is have these pledge cards. Ever see that? So we're going to build the building, and so everybody's got to promise something, right? He doesn't have that. Okay? Whatever he may be prospered in, it's what money did you get? Then put some aside from that. Okay? Not, I think I'll have this, and think I'll have that, and so I'll pledge the money. There's no indication of pledging. The next one here, Paul did not want collection for the needs of other saints to be a panicky affair, crashed, or pressured at the last minute. We got this missionary showed up. Let's pass the plate. None of that. Finally, Paul wanted to see that the gifts of the Corinthian saints were escorted with adequate security. See, in biblical times, it was quite common for people to get attacked along the roadway to see if, they had some money, especially if somebody was by themselves. And this is, for example, Jesus talks about the Good Samaritan. Somebody getting attacked along some open roadway going by themselves was a pretty common hazard. And so one of the things that they would do is have several people carrying the money so that you don't have that vulnerability. Well, one of the principles that fits with us is looking carefully and saying, is this really getting to the place it's supposed to go?
And so it means looking carefully at how is this money being used. This, you know, and maybe even, you know, give it specifically right here because you want to make sure that the money gets where it's supposed to be. Christians have had a habit at times of just kind of, you know, throwing money at something and thinking that God's happy with that. And that's not what this implies. This talks about taking care, about making sure that money is going where it's supposed to go. Back in the 80s, there was a televangelist couple that, you know, kind of came apart at the seams. And, I mean, it was just at auctions, you know, for all their stuff. And they had things like an $8,000 doghouse, you know, that they auctioned off. Wow. and just phenomenal sums of money that people were just throwing away at this ministry. Randy was located there down in Texas, and so he, you know, kept an eye on one of the televangelists that's popular now, and Benny Hinn, you still see him. And the guy's making several hundred million dollars a year. And there's just no accounting for, you know, where does all this several hundred million dollars a year go to, you know. Craziness. And then, so there's even an organization that's been set up to monitor, you know, skeptically, what those guys are doing. And it's a big enough thing that guy actually got an office and all this kind of thing, you know, monitoring what this other ministry is doing. I think the point is, it's just whatever the Lord is leading you to give to, it needs to be followed through with some sense of, you know, is this really going where it ought to go? Is this, and so making wise decisions about where the money ends up, a good thing. And Christians ought to think carefully, not just, you know, here's the check and it's out of sight, out of mind. It's not a good idea. So, anyway, it's the encouragement to give, but give carefully. Give with prudence. Give with a good sense of responsibility. Make people account for things.
Okay? Just what we were talking about before with promising out future income.
Mm-hmm.
Remember this term, faith promise?
Yeah.
It's like if you really have faith, then you'll promise to...
Yeah, faith promise, pledge. But the problem is you don't see that here. And you put faith on it. You know, it sounds like that's real biblical. Well, but that's not what Scripture lays out, is it? So you won't find us doing that here. You know?
In other words, Vern, what you're saying, being diligent in giving of your money and time,
mm-hmm.
as you are in spending money in any other area of your life.
Yeah.
Don't just throw it out the window.
That's right. Yeah. Redeem the time, redeem the money too. Okay. And something else, it is quite possible for Christians to, you know, look at these funds that are going out, and we can put terms on them that suddenly make it sound like it's biblical. But there's an important distinction between faith and presumption. If I pledge or faith promise, I am presuming. God has not promised me that future income flow. Therefore, if I make a promise based on some income flow, it's not faith. Faith is faith that is faith in the facts and what God's revealed. It's presumption. And there's an important distinction between faith and presumption.
So faith is believing what God says, not what...
Yes, faith is believing what God says, not making a huge stab out there and saying we're going to believe God for this. That's what our friend in Uganda did. He went and told everybody, you know, the Lord's going to make, you know, build us a new church building by this time, you know. No, that's not faith. That's presumption.
And in fact, he ended up essentially lying to them. Because that's faith is believing what God has said. That's faith. But when we go and, you know, pick some target out there and say that we're going to believe God for it, God didn't say it, so we're not, that's not faith, that is presuming upon God.
Well, the other thing that I've heard them stack onto that is you believe God for those funds that you've committed out of your faith.
Yes, right. But that comes out of what's called the Word of Faith movement, where, you know, you go and presume something and then call that faith. But you put faith in what God has revealed, not faith in what you have a hunch about, or faith in some blind, you know, dartboard target. We have, was it Oral Roberts, you know, if people don't give this many $1 million, God's going to kill me. You know, this is presumptuous, you know. And this is also blackmailing everybody, you know. It's your guys' fault that God killed me. Well, he died recently, so I guess something must have gone wrong. Anyway.
Okay. Now, top of page 19. That helps, you might say, but what about how much to give? If we leave the tithe one-tenth by the wayside, then what's the right amount? For starters, we have the proportionality principle, whatever he may be prospered in. Okay? So a part of the question, you know, what money's come in? So again, notice it's not faith based on presuming some amount, but it's faith in, here's the actual facts, whatever you may be prospered in. What money do you see right in front of you? Okay? So that's a part of it. We have some additional insight from what Paul later wrote to the Corinthian church about giving, 2 Corinthians 9:7. Each one must do as he has purposed in his heart. Purposed, decided, okay, in his heart. So to get this, and this is in the context of a giving passage, each one must do or give as he has purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. Not giving, even though I'd really like to make this a smaller amount. Not under compulsion, you know, I don't really want to give, but man, that guy is twisting my arm. Okay? Or I've made a faith pledge, but, you know, I don't know how we're going to eat. For God loves a cheerful giver. I heard a story once about these two boys who were in church, and it was a church where they passed the offering plate. And they sat next to this guy that they knew was a very wealthy banker. And so they'd watch as the plate would go by, and this banker dropped a dime in the offering plate. And so anyway, they both, you know. And the next week, you know, they watched the same thing. Finally, after the service, they confronted the banker. And they said, we've seen that you put a dime in the offering plate for last Sunday and this Sunday. And the banker said, well, the Lord loves a cheerful giver, and a dime is all I can cheerfully give. But if you look at what is in this passage, it focuses on some, in basically just one verse, some really key points. We see again the each one, just like last time, okay, each one. So there's not like, you know, okay, that doesn't apply to me. So each one, and it's an individual matter. It's also individual. It's not a, you know, yeah, we're going to crank and twist your arm and, you know, browbeat you. My daughter Becky and her husband Kurt went to a church that had the name Grace in its title. But they decided not to go there after every week, after week, after week, after week. They got up and twisted arms and browbeat people just before the giving of the offering. But critically notice that Paul makes the matter of giving, takes it out of the realm of these magical percentages. You notice here's 1 Corinthians 16. Did he give you a percentage? Here's 2 Corinthians chapter 9. Is he a percentage?
No.
First, the giving is to be measured at the heart level, not by a righteous percentage. And that's what some people really struggle with. It has to do with one's relationship with the Lord.
But you know, I think the point is too, it is not that if I give, God's going to be a little happier.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the typical, I think, you know, there's someone in a cheerful giver that, you know, if I give, God will bless me. God's going to be a little happier with me.
Yeah.
That's totally flesh.
Yeah, it can be a positive thing. How much do I give to make God happy? Or the negative side, like I talked about before, how much do I have to pay to get God off my back? You know, it's kind of the negative, cynical approach.
So I have this, what is it, the can't outgive God?
Yes.
So if I get 10, I get 12, right?
Well, and that's the prosperity doctrine teaching. But notice it doesn't, that's not what shows up here. This is a genuinely spiritual set of principles. And notice it's not terribly complicated, but it will frustrate some people because they want a magic number. But it comes back to your relationship with the Lord. That's where the giving principle in the New Testament starts with, not the magic number. Secondly, the giving is not to be grudgingly, with the internal sense of wishing they were not giving. So if the grudging addresses our internal feelings about the giving. Okay? It is not to be given out of, yeah, I'm giving this amount, but I don't really want it. The next one, it's not to be made from some external compulsion. I made a promise. That guy's beating me up terribly. He's telling me that if I don't give, you know, God's not going to bless me or something. So all the browbeating, arm twisting, badgering that typifies some so-called Christian ministries is not by God's desire and intent. I've been to one church where they pass the offering plate 3 times. Wow. Finally, the Lord is looking for giving to be done cheerfully. Cheerful giving will take place when the giver understands God's perspective on money and ministry, including the things we've been addressing here. Cheerful giving will take place when the handling and use of money in the ministry is worthy of the gifts. So that's a part of it, is maybe there's a begrudging because you ought not to be giving to this ministry, or at least in this way. In other words, if there's some reason for you to question whether this money is really being used effectively, then maybe you shouldn't be giving to that ministry.
Well, that brings to bear, I mean, you need to know exactly what that ministry is doing.
Yeah, what are they doing with this?
You have a right to ask any missionary, what's your monthly income? What do you do with that money? How do you live? Same within the church.
That's right.
Any other organization that you deem worthy of cheerfully giving to.
Yeah. There are some ministries out there where they are living high on the hog. Some of the big time televangelists out there now have private jets. Have an airport right next to their house. Have multiple limos. Wear highly jeweled, you know, watches and things of that sort. Everything is, you know, top drawer catered, full time chef, sometimes full time chef and staff, you know. Some of them are living way high on the hog, and it's even got to the point where several of them called before Congress with having this kind of thing questioned. Because having that standard of living and having some sort of tax status that gives them exemption, that's kind of crazy. So, even the world doesn't believe it.
So if you look at it, these are some key principles here for giving. We've had from that 1 Corinthians 16 passage, and now from the 2 Corinthians 9:7, some they're concise. They're not terribly complicated. I will tell you that the wrestling point that people have with this is that giving is not superficial. It's not just here's the right number and you're good to go. It all comes back to relationship with the Lord. It comes back to considering carefully the ministries that you're giving to and giving some thought to it. For husband and wife to talk about it. And to both have both of them be settled in their hearts about what they're giving to. And do be careful about what you give to. Very important. The next part there, in order to make clear what this does not mean, there is no biblical basis for Christian ministries to pressure for donations by law, guilt, badgering, false promises about material rewards on earth, faith pledges, emotional appeals, etc. Such approaches appeal to the flesh in one way or another and will therefore reap to the flesh. I would suggest to you that churches that use these approach are giving you a strong signal that that's not the place to give. In other words, if you're saying, is this being used wisely? A part of it comes to how are they appealing for the money. So, anyway, to simplify this in bullets here, giving to Christian ministry should be proportional household income received. And again, not presuming on future income. Systematic, regular accumulation. Okay, and voluntary, based on a relationship with the Lord. With neither an internal begrudging or an external compulsion. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. If you'd like to talk more about that or something, or have other questions, feel free. But I think, you know, this is worth taking the time. We've taken up a good chunk of time to go through this, but I think it's well worth taking the time because it's really valuable stuff. There is a section on taxes. I'm going to address just part of it. It's real interesting. Remember where Jesus is challenged? Should we pay taxes to Caesar? And if you look on page 21, I've got a picture of these are the coins that were available. And the bottom one was the one, you know, should we pay taxes to Caesar? And notice, what did Jesus do? Did he pull a coin out of his own pocket? No. No, what did he do? He asked for them to produce the coin. Now, that was very wise on his part. And the reason is this. Look at this coin at the bottom part. It's kind of the darker coins. And what you see on the front and on the back, those are both images of what they considered, because Merol was the emperor, a pagan deity, right? So they had an image of a pagan deity. What did the law of Moses say? You should not have any graven images, right? So by producing this coin, they had in their own pockets an image of a pagan deity on both sides of this coin. Okay? And so that was one for asking them to produce it. They were kind of fessing up to, you know, we're violating the law of Moses here by holding this coin with a pagan deity on each side. And one of the promises in Deuteronomy 28 is if you're obedient to the Lord, you won't be subject to any other outside country. And why? Whose coin is this? And that's the question he asked, right? Whose image is on the coin? It's Caesar's, right? Who's Caesar? Is Caesar Jewish? No. Okay? So by having them produce the coin, two confessions. One is we have a graven image, okay, on this coin. And secondly, Secondly, this is a Roman coin, not a Jewish coin, and therefore we are under somebody else because it's an outright admission that because we're under somebody else, we are obviously disobedient. Okay? So by having them produce the coin, he had them make two confessions right there. And that's why he asked them to say, you know, give me the coin, you produce it, and whose image is on it? Okay? And they produced it, they made the open confession. And he answers, give to Caesar what's Caesar's, give to God what's God's. I have had the instance even here at Holly Hills of dealing with tax protesters, but I won't go into the detail here. Scripture makes it abundantly clear that paying the taxes that are due is biblical. Even if the tax, the basis for the income tax in the United States, it was not properly instituted, and I believe it was not. But even on the basis of this Matthew 22 passage we show on page 22, and on Romans 13, 1 through 7, there is no reason for, you know, being a tax protester, biblically. Pay them. Okay? And one of the justifications is so that we don't offend them. Even if it was a tax they didn't have to pay. Now, the one thing I can't promise you is that every time you go fishing, you'll find the taxes in the fish's mouth for you to pay. Sorry, can't promise that. Okay, we're going to shift over here on to page 24, living within our means. And this is the principle that is not commonly taught in the United States, but living within our means is God's ultimate intent here. We have several passages there on page 24 that point to what God intends. One of them there is Proverbs 6:6 through 8. Go to the ant, O sluggard, observe her ways and be wise, which, having no chief officer or ruler, prepares her food in the summer and gathers her provision in the harvest. So what do you see coming out of that passage? What are some of the things that you see?
Looking to the future.
Okay, looking to the future and doing what?
Saving
for the future, right? So that the ants aren't going out trying to find somebody else who has saved to borrow from them, okay? So saving for the future from current things. What else do you see?
Well, it seems like they're identifying that when you have prosperity, you set aside.
Okay, so during the time when you have, you set aside, right, for the time when you don't have. Okay, so that's one. What else do you see? Yeah, yeah. This isn't, we do this because somebody's driving us and, you know, forcing us, but essentially seeing a responsibility to get out there and work.
Also knows that it's a her.
Okay. Yeah. That interesting? Yeah. Yeah. Strange things the way they run. Okay. Something else. As you look in this, there is a mindset of preparation. A mindset of preparation. Okay. Looking to the future. We're preparing for things. That's something we'll talk about as we get farther along. Proverbs 22:7: the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. It's something that both Larry Burkett and Dave Ramsey point to. And I think that is valid, that when we borrow, there's an implication there. We're now the slave of the one from whom we borrow. It doesn't mean it's automatically bad, but it does create a position and an obligation to borrow. Okay? So the Bible doesn't prohibit borrowing, but it gives you the wisdom of, you know, realize what you're doing. Okay? Realize what you're doing. borrowing, why does borrowing make a person the lender's slave?
Because you're in debt to them.
You're in debt to them, okay. And how does that happen?
You have to pay it back.
You have to pay it back, right? All right. And then what does that do? It dictates things in your life. That's why they use the picture of a slave. I must do this because I have to pay this back. It also means I am not free to make other choices. So borrowing creates a position where you have an obligation to pay that back, therefore you're going to do this and this and this. If you were not borrowing, then you would be free. That's the idea of not being a slave. You would be free to make other choices, free to make other decisions. Here's the next one that is kind of the flip side of the preparing. A prudent man sees evil and hides himself. The naive proceed and pay the penalty. If you see a hazard in the financial realm, you don't step into it. Okay? You don't step into what's a foreseeable hazard. Foreseeable risk. The next one, the ants are not a strong people, but they prepare their food in the summer. Similar to the Proverbs 6 reference there. In Luke 14, and I'll rather summarize it, the Lord himself here talks about, you know, which of you wants to build the tower does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it. Okay? Planning ahead, looking for future preparation. Otherwise, when he's laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who observe begin to ridicule him. This man began when he wasn't able to finish, or a king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle and not first sit down, consider whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000. Or else, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. When we see something ahead, to act prudently in view of what's ahead. I've seen situations where people will run up the credit cards. Oh, I know how we'll pay that credit card. We'll get another one. And we'll charge that payment against this. And they go, you know, running that. And I've actually heard of situations where people have numbers upwards of 400,000 in credit card bills running in that way before the house of cards collapses. Oh, boy. 2 Corinthians 12. Which we'll get to eventually in our study. Here for this third time, I am ready to come to you, and I will not be a burden to you, for I will not seek what is yours, but you, for children are not responsible to save up for the parents, but parents for the children. Saving up for future needs, whatever those needs might be. Okay? James 14, 13 through 16. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go in such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit, yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Making plans without figuring the Lord's... What does the Lord want from this? And perhaps the Lord may do something different than what we assume. Okay? Including the Lord in all of our plans. That's what he's talking about. One of the things we'll talk about, and we've accommodated in the back here, is... I would say it's not necessary for everyone, but it is often advisable. We have forms here for a monthly budget. Some people have complained, oh, that's the law. Well, I would protest. Let me tell you what happened with Nancy and I. Back in 1989, I came to a kind of an all crash point with several different things in my life. And one of the things that you know, I said, Nancy, we have $20,000 in credit card debt, which 20 years ago was even more than today. We have $20,000 in credit card debt. Our house is mostly mortgage, and we need to get that taken care of. So we sat down and made a budget. Now, what's interesting is, it's funny, every month, because I would do it and then sit down with her and talk it through and sometimes make adjustments. Every month, we end up saying, boy, I'm glad we're doing this. Boy, I'm glad we're doing this. Wow, man, am I glad we're doing this. And we, you know, made a plan for how we're going to do it, and it's because we looked at our spending. So this budget sheet, you probably have a couple of them there right at the very back, is for making out a monthly budget. If you are interested, I can send you a spreadsheet that includes a whole year. You can go a whole year at a time if you like. We found it was a little better ourselves to do it a month at a time, because then we talked about it at a regular interval. It worked out very well to do that. And then we got to the next thing that we'll talk about, and that is we set a certain budget pages out for the kids. And so for each of the kids' clothing, we had a certain budget amount. And instead of having the previous thing where they would come, I need, and of course you don't know the difference between needs and wants, we would say, here's the amount that you get per month for clothing. You can spend it how you like, so it gives them some sense of planning and responsibility. You can spend it however you like, but you know, and some of the ways to handle it are, if you want to get some, you know, really expensive item, well, you wait another month, you know, in order to get enough money. Or you can go out and earn it. And one of the things we did is we had regular chores that the kids were required to do, and then we had additional chores that if they did, we would pay them for it, which we took out of another budget category, right? And so they could earn money, some money from us, and then they could also, you know, go through things like babysitting and, you know, newspaper delivery and, you know, work around the yard and things like that and earn their own money as well. But that way, they could begin to manage it. Once we showed them that, we never got any, I need, and all the whining and, you know, stuff that goes along with it. It never happened again, because they would instead just go to their budget page. You notice there's this budget summary sheet. That's what Nancy and I would work out. And from that, we would have the other sheet here where we'd have, okay, here's the description. It would say, you know, monthly amount in, and we would put the amount in for whatever it was. And then the amount out was what they spent, and then the balance. And if they wanted something that required them to earn extra money, which they could put in there, or if they wanted you know, something that was larger than what we would allocate for a month, then that was up to them. It's amazing how they learned to, you know, like, get good deals and shop around for a good price. And so it did a lot of good things for them. And I would recommend that if you got kids that you, you know, head that direction. At any rate, we were able to pay the $20,000 off in 18 months, get it all, you know, taken care of, and then begin to nail down the mortgage quickly. And it works. For us, it was a communication tool that really worked out well, because we could talk about, you know, what's important and doing things together. And one of the problems we'd had before is that by not having a budget and by having the debt, it put Nancy and I into almost a parent-child relationship, where I was the parent and she was the child, and, you know, I need money for the kids for this and that, and that was not a good thing. And so instead, this allowed her to be my wife, and we were together on it as a team. It was tremendous, the improvement. So anyway, I recommend it, even if a person is not trying to dig out of debt, it's still highly recommendable.
puts also money back into the realm of it's not the problem.
Yeah.
You've written it down. You can see it. Both of you have agreed on
the
plan as you proceed forward.
And where's the money going? Okay. Where's the money going this month? And one of the things I'd like to introduce, I'm not aware of it being an issue here, but Bruce has an interest in helping people who have substantial debt issues to try to get out. And one of the reasons I share it and introduce his interest is because as you are involved with the body, if you encounter someone who comes up with that. As I'm in credit card hell here. Tell them go see Bruce because Bruce can help them with working out how do you get out of this debt situation. How do you dig out? Okay. So anyway, an important introduction there, just as we move forward as a church body here.